well. So you want that forgiveness, but then you have your existing lines of credit and your existing notes. And how do you think about that? So after you've worked with your bank, negotiating any forbearance, you want to really start evaluating, when is business going to pick up? Is it going to be a quick recovery? Is it going to be a slow recovery? And that it depends completely on what industry, who the end user is. And depending on what industry we're seeing a lot in the industries where if you're selling to non-essential, that's not as quick of a recovery. Obviously, it's essential is going to be a quick recovery. And what's the ability for who you sell to pay? So really thinking through what's your true timeline, working on new cash flow projections for, and doing a scenario layout is really, really key and really, really crucial in this to determine and work with your CPA firm on your new cash flow projection. You want to see what variables need to change. Do you need to renegotiate some of your fixed costs due to your declining revenues, working with your landlord, selling any equipment that you have, or getting rid of unnecessary expenses? Expenses, you want to determine both your short and long-term strategy on that. And variable costs are oftentimes easier for you to scale with your declining revenues, and making sure that you can help overall with retaining cash until your revenues increase again. But, you know, the question is most of you already know those steps that you need to take, but what happens when that's not enough? What happens if you're not able to get the increasing credit? What happens if your bank, because you might not be in an industry that's going to turn around, what happens if that quickly? What happens if your bank decides that relationship is not going to continue forward? And you better than anyone would know, what does that look like for your business? What does that look like for your industry? So it's important to know some of your options. So, Melody, if you want to flip to the next slide. So I really want to review some of the various alternative lending strategies that are able to help your support your growth, whether it's a turnaround situation, or you might be some of the few that have had accelerated growth and the banks aren't able to increase your line. But you're in a position where you might need some sort of temporary help. So AR financing is one of, or also alternative called factoring, is one that allows you to leverage your accounts receivable to help with your cash conversion cycle and keeping more cash on hand. So you want it to, it's oftentimes used to pay your overhead expenses and other obligations that you might not otherwise be able to meet because you're waiting on getting paid. So what we're seeing a lot in the market, because a lot of the credit has tightened up, larger companies are delaying the terms in which they're paying their who it is that they're buying products or services from. You might have executed on your contract, provided products or services, but you're not going to get paid for another 30, 60, 90 days. And you still have employees, you still have rent, you still have more product that you need to buy, and you're waiting on that cash. So accounts receivable financing gives you that cash flow when you need that. It's based on what you have sold. So that's it's a real asset that allows you to help with that cash conversion cycle and keeping more cash on hand sooner. Typically, what LSQ does, and this is where we specialize in, is we purchase your invoices and advance you rates on average around 85%, usually anywhere from 75 to 90%, depending on industry and product. But we're able to do that to allow you to help keep the lights on. When the invoice terms draw near, LSQ receives that payment and we give you the remaining percent minus a small fee. So that's typically overall the general outline. Is obviously a lot more specific both to the product and how that works, but it really is one of the one types of alternative financing that helps you with your cash flow at the cheapest cost available. Well, if you want to click on one more slide. Oh, you're there. So, but oftentimes if that doesn't work and maybe you don't bill on terms, maybe that's not something that you have that's an issue, or you might get paid a lot faster. Sometimes you might look at other forms of financing. Purchase order financing is one that allows you to use a letter of credit or get cash to help you pay with some of those raw materials to manufacture your product. Oftentimes that's the ramp up period for the cost associated with making your product. It can be used for a one-time situation or ongoing that allows you to leverage somebody else's cash to help get your product made when cash is tight. Typically, the way that it works is as soon as that product is shipped out, then a factor such as LSQ would come in and purchase the receivables on that product that's shipped out, and we take out the purchase order financer to be able to help with that cash cycle. Inventory financing, it's pretty much what it sounds like. It takes and gives you an advance on the inventory that you have on hand. Advance rates on that typically are somewhere between 50 and 80% range, depending on the product that you have, your turnover, shelf life, and some other variables there. There's always a fee to get that type of product started, and you get to be able to pay based on what you use for that, for the advance, the funds availability. And as you're evaluating some of your fixed costs as well, you might have equipment already on hand, or you might still need to be buying new equipment. And equipment financing allows you to either buy new equipment, or you can get a loan against that equipment as well, where you might have 20% down, but you can get some funds based on that equipment as well. Once that's a pretty straightforward one as well. And that usually helps with that growth phase as well. So you don't have to take all your cash and leverage out your cash for your equipment. Last two, I'll touch on the construction and the medical. Those are both more specific industry. Oftentimes in construction, you have bonds and lien waivers and things of that nature that put financing at a little bit more risky. A lot of banks can't stay away from construction financing because of the bonds and lien waivers and the workarounds for general contractors and subcontractors. So we work with clients on specializing in that, along with medical accounts receivables for doctor's offices that might bill to insurance companies. So those are some different ways and some key alternative financing that's available that helps with the cash flow of companies when the traditional bank relationship isn't working. Our goal is always to get clients back to that bank because that's your best form of financing over the cost long term, but we are there and able to help when you're in a position that the traditional route is not working. So now the key part is making sure that if you did get PPP funds, getting that forgiveness and making sure that your business stays up and running throughout all this. So Rebecca, I will hand it over to you so you can talk about how to make sure the businesses that we work with are able to stay afloat.
Thank you, Brittany. So congratulations, the official PPP forgiveness application was published by the Small Business Administration. So we now know what it looks like. You're welcome to go and download it. Every single bank is going to use the same form, but your bank may ask you to submit that information in different formats, online, in a file upload. So a little flexibility about how the information will be gathered, but the information in today's presentation will apply to every single bank and lender, regardless of whether they were internet, regional, or national banks. So the most difficult part of looking at the application is, as a business owner or as an executive, you probably are an action-oriented person. And so you look at the first page and you think to yourself, yeah, no problem. I can totally start filling this out. And I'll get through the first four or five information blocks and then suddenly realize, there's all these other things I need to calculate. So instead, we're going to ask you to start with the end in mind. There are four things that you need to calculate before you sit down and start filling out your application. Today, we're going to go through those four things to make it easier for you to complete your application and to maximize your loan forgiveness. The four things we're going to cover: the covered period, how much did you spend during the covered period, the mysterious reference period, the PPP definition of a full-time employee, and kind of a fun analogy to help you think about how owners have gotten paid.
All right, Melody. Yep. Okay. So now that, as Rebecca said, we kind of want to work backwards, right? So we are going to start with figuring out the covered period. And there's actually also this alternative payroll covered period, right? So the reason the covered period is important is if you've got a PPP loan, hopefully you understand and know by now that in order to get loan forgiveness, you have a limited number of things that you can use those loan proceeds for, right? And the majority of it, it was intended as a protection of employee payroll. So 75% or more has to be used for payroll costs. And you have a limited amount of time to use those payroll, to use that money and to pay for that payroll. And that's the covered period. And the covered period for you, if you've got a PPP loan, starts on the day you got your funds from your bank, and it's 8 weeks from that date. What is fortunate about when the government released this application and some of the rules along with the application is they gave you all an alternative. They gave you an alternative payroll covered period. And the reason they gave you that is for administrative convenience. If you think about it, if you got your loan money in the middle of the payroll period, how are you going to figure out, split up that payroll period? Is it part of the payroll period and not the rest of it? It's a big headache, quite frankly. And fortunately, this is one of those areas where they made it a little simpler for you all. So you have the option of using an alternative payroll covered period, which begins on the first day that your payroll starts, the payroll period immediately following when you got the money. So let's say you got your money on April 20th and you have a payroll starting on April 23rd. April 23rd can be your start date for that 8 week period. For payroll costs. We'll talk about non-payroll costs later, but payroll, you can use that alternative payroll period. And I would just say, do yourself a favor and use the alternative payroll cover period. I don't really think there's any that I can think of in a normal scenario, huge advantage to using the covered period. I think in the end, you're going to be thankful to have a simple method here. The caution I will say is that you have to read that application very carefully. There are times in the application where it specifically says use the covered period or the alternative payroll covered period. In that scenario, you obviously can choose your alternative. There are other times where the application says you must only use the covered period for this specific thing. So you just need, it's a little bit of a dense application, but like Rebecca said, if you start backwards and gather this info first, we think we've got confidence that you'll be able to pull all this together. We can go to the next slide. So the next thing that you all have to kind of figure out that kind of goes hand in hand with the covered period is what are your payroll costs, right? And the reason we kind of put this calendar there is for you to be thinking about the big question that was circulating before we got this application and some of the recent rules was, is it when the employee earns the pay or is it when you actually make the payment? Because those are two different things in most jobs, right? And so we now know that it's actually both. It can be, they're considered, they're eligible for forgiveness on the day that it's earned. And they use the word incurred for earned, kind of the same concept. or the day that it's paid, as long as it's in that covered period. The way that's going to work in most scenarios is that the employee is going to earn the pay during that covered period or the alternative, and you're going to pay it during that covered period or the alternative because it's an 8-week span. So in most scenarios, it's going to all be in one. What's going to happen at the very end of that 8-week period is you're probably going to have employees who have earned pay, but you haven't actually paid it during that 8-week period. And that's okay. You still get to include it if the employee earned it during that 8-week period, as long as you pay the employee in the next payroll period immediately following your 8 weeks, kind of a mouthful, but as long as you do that, then it's covered. So again, if you break it down, it can be some pretty simple concepts for you as long as you're walking through the steps. A couple other things I want to kind of cover on this topic was what's included in your payroll costs. And a lot of this info has been floating around for a while, so you may already kind of have a handle on it, but you know, payroll costs are salary, wages, commissions, similar kind of compensation to that. You cannot count employees who make more than $100,000. It's capped at $100,000, and that's going to be prorated over that 8-week period. A couple things that are new that we've recently found out, but again, I think are good things for you all, is number one, bonuses. There's a big question around whether bonuses are going to be included, because if you think about it, you know, people want to use the money, right, for a forgiveness purpose. But what happens, you know, can I give my employees bonuses to kind of, you know, get it into a forgiveness purpose? And it appears currently, as Melody said, things are kind of always changing. So I say it with a little bit of, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But the rules in the application now say bonuses count. My cautionary there is that if you are an owner employee, this is probably a logical point, but do not pay yourself a large bonus as an owner employee and think that you're going to be okay on the forgiveness side. I think a bonus to an employee, staff employee, is different than I would expect the SBA to be looking very closely at compensation to owner employees. So just be cautious of that. The other good news that we got was if you're keeping your employees furloughed because you're one of those businesses that has not been able to get back in full force because you're not an essential business or the demand just isn't there, you can actually pay furloughed employees and it will still count. So those are, we can go to the next slide. Okay, now we're going to, there is a lot of information on this next topic, and I'm going to just kind of hit some highlights, because again, we can't possibly cover it in an entire hour, but, you know, the reference period was kind of the second thing in the working backwards. The reason the reference period is important for you all is because calculating your payroll costs is the first thing you do, right? You're going to get, and you get loan forgiveness as long as you're using it for an eligible payroll cost. However, your forgiveness eligibility is going to be reduced by two factors. If you had a reduction in the number of your full-time equivalent employees, or if you had a reduction in your actual compensation to those employees. And the way the SBA determines whether there's been a reduction is they look to a reference period. So you have to pick what that reference period is going to be. And you have some options here based on what's going to work best for you to maximize that forgiveness. So you can either pick a reference period of February 15th through June 30th of 2019, or you can pick a reference period of January 1st through February 29th of 2020. Or the third option is for seasonal employers, there's kind of this formula for what period you can use there if you're a seasonal business. So as far as which one do you pick, you know, I think you really need to kind of be looking at all three options and figuring out, remember, the reason you're picking the reference period is to compare it to what your 8-week covered period looks like. So you want to pick the one that maximizes that minimizes any kind of reductions that went on. You want to pick the one that looks closest to your covered period. There is an important, this number two here, stay at home orders and reopening. And we've actually, this is, I think, such a key point, we've put in that FTE reduction safe harbor is lifted directly from the application. If you restore your employment back to the level it was before, then you will not get dinged for this reduction. And so, you know, the way that works is, if you had to reduce your number of employees or your salaries, and that happened between February 15th and April 26th, that timeline kind of makes sense. That's when a lot of these reductions were happening across the country as the pandemic kind of came in and things were shutting down. If that was when your reduction happened, then you have till June 30th, so you've got about another month, to get everybody back on payroll who was on payroll before at their same salary levels. And if you do that, then you're not gonna get dinged for any kind of reduction when you look at your forgiveness amount. Mallory, you can go to the next one. I'm gonna pass it back to Rebecca.
Thanks, Sarah. So we're gonna take a brief interlude to ask you to remember the last time you were with your family at Thanksgiving. So maybe last year, maybe when you were a kid, which table did you sit at? Did you sit at the grown-ups table, the bonus table, or were you on the porch? And when you've had a moment to reimagine and re-experience that event, we're gonna move forward and we'll come back to that interlude in just a moment. Melody. Let's talk about what qualifies as a full-time employee. Under PPP forgiveness, there are two methods. They're both acceptable. You may run both scenarios to see which one's more advantageous for you. The easy method is take each person who works more than 40 hours and presto, you have one FTE. Anyone who works under 40 counts as half. And that, and notice the small print there, that's the same as if they work 10 hours or 39 hours. And so that's kind of a place where some businesses will have an advantage and some businesses will say, no, a lot of my employees work 35. Maybe I want to look at that differently. The other method is kind of more traditional. Take everyone who works 40 or more, put them in one pool. Take everyone who's left over, add up the hours they worked, divide by 40, and you get a new FTE count. Both methods are acceptable. Melody, let's talk about Thanksgiving. Two more down. So if you remembered your Thanksgiving experience and you thought, I already sat at table one. Well, for PPP purposes, table one is one of the schedules and forms that you fill out in preparation to complete your application. And so table one is for all your employees who make less than or equal to $100,000 a year. You list those employees on this schedule. Next schedule. Table two is for all the people who make more than $100,000 a year. You list them on table two. We really want to encourage you. It feels a little tedious to list all of that out, but the table one and the table two are going to be used extensively as you fill out and complete the application. So doing this exercise to start you off is probably the biggest time saver. So if you were one of the people who had to sit on the porch, guess what? That's just like the calculation for what has been paid to owner employees or self-employed people or general partners. It's excluded from the schedule table one, schedule table two, and it has its own line on the application. So to Sarah's earlier point, the SBA has an opportunity to focus on that number a little more and scrutinize how owners or self-employed individuals are paying themselves compared to the rest of their payroll. So I think we've all realized during the COVID crisis something that has always been true, and that is that adulting is hard. Especially true for business owners, because you may offer your employees an opportunity to come back to work or to come back on the payroll as a furloughed employee, But they may rationally say, look, I'm getting super unemployment benefits. I'm getting enhanced benefits from the federal government. And I was able to get onto the state roll. And so I may be making as much or even more than I would make if I came back to work. So I want to gracefully decline your offer of reemployment because I'm better off economically. This leaves the employer in a really difficult situation because they've gotten PPP money, but they don't have employees. And so there's kind of a strange balance that Sarah is going to help explain how to thread that needle and how to find a safe harbor. The other question we've gotten a lot from our clients and friends and people in the community is, what happens if you had to let someone go for cause? And you know, that's always an unfortunate and unhappy event, but it happens during this 8-week period. And so how does PPP look at losing that full-time equivalent, but deliberately, not because you didn't bring them back on?
Okay, so as Rebecca kind of set the stage here, these are two kind of hot topic questions. So employees who decline to return to work. And this is again, and I, you know, there's been a lot of, and there still is, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions, right? And there's a lot of things about the PPP process that have been frustrating, and maybe we are not getting the answers we need, or there's a lot of uncertainty. And to focus on the positive, there have been some developments where the SBA has given employers, I believe, some good resources, some good mechanisms to help you through the process. And this is one of those. They've given us kind of a clear answer on what to do here. So importantly, the employee in that situation, as Rebecca described, who says thanks but no thanks, it is not going to count against you in those reductions if, and there's an important if here, there are very specific factors that they kind of spelled out in the rule, and so you need to make sure you're documenting this. You need to make a good faith written, it has to be a written offer to rehire an employee. Now, practically speaking, you know, you're a restaurant, you're rehiring all your employees. I'm guessing you're not sending them all letters and saying, come back. You're picking up the phone, you're telling people when to come back. That's fine. But if you have an employee who you call and then they say, I don't want to come back, you need to follow up with a written letter at that point. You need to offer it in writing. It needs to be for the same wages and hours as before your layoff, before this COVID crisis. And you know, the employee, another factor is obviously the employee voluntarily on their own rejects the offer. You can't manage whether an employee actually rejects it in writing, right? Like, you know, you can't necessarily dictate, I need you to present me that, rejection in writing, but you can document your file for that rejection. So however that rejection comes in, you need to document it and maintain your records. And then this last one is very new. This, we had some of this information several weeks ago, and we knew about 1, 2, 3, and 4. We just learned about the fifth condition very recently, last Friday night when they released some updates. And this one is an important one because I think it could easily be overlooked if an employer is not aware of it. And that is that you have to actually inform the state unemployment insurance office of the employee's rejection within 30 days of the rejection. The reason they're requiring that is because they, as a matter of employment law, somebody who declines an offer to get reemployed might be ineligible for unemployment insurance. So I would, again, this is not a requirement, but I'd suggest that what if an employee rejects the offer, you as the employer may want to advise them that, hey, I'm required by law to notify the unemployment insurance office. This may affect your ability to collect unemployment. You don't have to say any more than that. You're not their legal advisor, but I think it would be good practice to put employees on notice of that because you are gonna have to do that. Now, what we don't know at this point is exactly how that reporting mechanism is gonna work. The SBA tells us they're going to release some further guidance on exactly how to go about reporting that info. So to be continued on that one. We can go to the next slide. Did we miss a slide?
I think we missed.
Oh, I think we might be. Well, go forward one more. Employees terminated for cause. Well, I'll start talking. We can hopefully try to find the employees terminated for cause. It's a pretty simple concept. Employees terminate, I'm on slide 18, I think.
Working on it.
Okay, perfect. So employees terminated for cause, another big question we all had, right? Like, what if, you know, does this mean that for 8 weeks I essentially can't fire an employee if they've done something horrible, you know, and I have a just reason for terminating them? Well, the SBA said no. You know what? There we go. Ding, ding, ding. Employees who are terminated for cause voluntarily resign. So same thing. You can't control if an employee in this 8 week period is going to voluntarily resign. You also cannot control if an employee voluntarily requests some kind of reduced schedule. So if any of those apply, then again, that's not going to be a ding against you. It's not going to be a detriment to your forgiveness amount. Here you do have to, there aren't specific steps like in the employee not wanting to come back, but it is clear that you do need to maintain records of this. So again, not a requirement that you put everything in writing, but if I were giving you legal advice, I would be saying document, because you need to keep those records to show later on if the SBA comes back and says, we don't think this person was terminated for cause. So keep your records relating to it, and you can kind of breathe easy. If you need to terminate someone for cause, that's okay. It's not going to affect your forgiveness amount.
So let's explore the mystery of Schedule A. Once we've completed Table 1, Table 2, and calculated owner compensation, we are now ready to turn to the form called Schedule A. And the thing about Schedule A is it's really simple if you've completed the two tables and the owner calculation. And as you can see on the screen, line 1 just says, go to Table 1, enter on line 1 what's in Box 1. And you can literally follow along Schedule A, take the information from the tables, bring it into the schedule, and you'll just breeze through this pretty straightforward, very simple. Once you've completed Schedule A, now we are finally ready to go back and fill out the actual application for forgiveness. So now we have all the information we need, and the actual application, pretty simple, fairly straightforward if you've calculated those four things that you need before you get started. Let's look at some of the math around that actual application.
Working on it.
It's okay. We got time. All right. So here we can see that everything we did on Schedule A, again, is going to flow over into the actual application. So we start with the end in mind. And here, we've already made all of the calculations. We just put these into the correct line items and follow along. What's beautiful about the way the application is designed, and I know that's a strange thing to say about a government form, is that the way they've created the math and the follow along to calculate your forgiveness is so straightforward that if you calculated Table 1, Table 2, and filled out Schedule A, it's really incredibly straightforward. It does not have to be anxiety producing whatsoever. Let's talk a little bit about some non-payroll costs, an area with a lot of interest.
Okay, so non-payroll costs. Not quite as, not as complicated necessarily as the calculation of the payroll costs, right? It's a little more straightforward. You either have them or you don't, you either paid them or you didn't. But there are some things that you kind of need to be aware of when you're looking at them to make sure you don't get tripped up and make sure you don't put something in there that's going to jeopardize your forgiveness later on. So eligible non-payroll costs, only three other things, mortgage interest payments. And I've emphasized interest payments there because it's only mortgage interest. It's not principal payments. So if your mortgage, and this is obviously a business mortgage, it's not your personal mortgage, it's for the business, But if your mortgage payments include principal and interest, you need to only be including in your forgiveness request the interest portion. You also can't make prepayments and use it to get loan forgiveness. Lease payments, again, business lease payments, and business utility expenses. And the utilities are pretty broad, and everything you would kind of typically think of for utilities. Couple things to think about here, the timing on the obligation. You do not have an alternative covered payroll. You do not have an alternative covered period here. It is just the covered period. So it's your 8 weeks starting from when you got the money. It has to be paid during that covered period, or again, they kind of recognize there's going to be that conundrum, right? Like, what if your 8 week period ends today on May 28th, and you pay your rent on June 1, and you're paying on June 1 for what's already been incurred. If you've got that kind of scenario, if you've incurred it during the covered period, as long as you pay it on the next regular billing date, then you're good. Then you get to include it. So you could have multiple lease payments within this 8 week covered period. The timing on the obligation is, and this is kind of to prevent, you can't get a PPP loan and then run out and buy a piece of property and then get that covered. You have to have entered into your mortgage, lease, or utility agreement before February 15th of 2020. So it was an existing obligation when this need for PPP arose. One other cautionary thing that I want to make note of, because this kind of has been developing since the application came out, and that's this debate on whether mortgage and lease payments can go towards real property only or real property and personal property. The rule and the application seem to suggest that you can use it for personal property interest mortgage payments or personal property lease payments. Again, though, this would be a scenario where, just like if it's a payment to an owner, if you're thinking about using a payment on personal property, I would stop for a minute. I would spend some time really thinking through that. Remember, personal property has a very specific purpose in the SBA regulations. It's things like business equipment, leases, things like that. You typically don't mortgage things like equipment. So I don't know that it fits into a mortgage interest payment. So again, there's a lot of conversation out there floating on that. And I would just say, spend some time thinking through that, talking to your advisors on that one. If it's a cost you want to try to get loan forgiveness on. We can go to the next one. So I think this is the final thought that I have before I turn it back over to Rebecca. Just wanted to talk a little bit about legal certifications. Again, a really hot topic and things that were, quite frankly, I think, causing a lot of people some heartburn over the PPP as it developed after the first phase. So this is just kind of a reminder, you will have to sign a bunch of certifications when you submit your loan forgiveness application. This picture on the slide is not all of them. It's just kind of a couple. It's just kind of the highlights of things to think about. You're going to be certifying that everything in that application is true and correct. Everything was used for an authorized purpose. And acknowledging that the federal government could pursue remedies if you're not. So again, my advice is, one person from your organization has to be signing this, right? But if you're gathering information from other people or you need information from other people, make sure you're getting all of your ducks in a row and you're documenting what you have. The certifications are going to be taken seriously. There's been a lot of discussion of, what they're going to be doing with them. And we don't really know, we don't have a crystal ball, but the SBA has said that they will and can review any loan of any size at any point in time. And there was some talk at one point about, you know, there's this magic $2 million number, and that still exists. There's a little bit of a safe harbor for you there, but I don't want to emphasize that safe harbor too much, because the reality is the SBA can come back and audit any one of these loans. So just make sure you've got your ducks in a row on the documentation, which I think leads into what Rebecca wanted to touch on. You're on mute. Rebecca, you're on.
So here are some best practices before we get into our Q&A period. For the most part, all lenders are going to require electronic documents. This could be scanned documents. It could be copies that were sent to you from your payroll company. But everything's going to be in electronic format. Some lenders are going to require what in the industry is called a wet signature. It's a signature that's physical, usually with a blue pen is preferred. It's kind of an old habit. Or an e-sign electronic signature, not typed in, but from an e-sign provider with digital encryption. So the old idea that you could type in your initials or type in your name may not be accepted by some lenders. Please remember your lender has 60 full days from the time you submit both the application and all the relevant supporting documents. This shouldn't cause you a tremendous amount of anxiety though, because for PPP loans, the first 6 months, all interest and principal payments are not collected. So you're not having to make payments during that 60-day review period. It's just an opportunity for the lender to deal with an avalanche of forgiveness requests that will be coming at us. Very importantly, you need to keep all your records for 6 years, because to Sarah's earlier point, the SBA has the right to review any loan that was made through the PPP forgiveness program. So you want to make sure you've kept the backup calculations and documentation. A couple quick notes. The SBA had a period of time where companies who had a moment and realized they didn't really want to take the money or shouldn't have taken the money, they could give the money back, no questions asked. That safe harbor or good faith period has expired. So everyone who's taken money is now going to be accountable for either applying for forgiveness or repaying the loan over the loan term. Lastly, we have a good faith safe harbor that if you made a loan under $2 million, received a loan under $2 million, we're going to assume that you, in good faith, applied for the loan. But that in no way prevents the SBA from coming back and looking at the information or your calculations. So just because you're under $2 million, it's not a free pass. Last slide.
Working on it.
It's all good. So we started our presentation that's saying the only thing that's constant here is change. And that is even more evident today than we've seen in the last few weeks. So this morning, the House of Representatives passed the Paycheck Protection Flexibility Act. And it, as proposed, is going to have some significant changes. So there are two bills that are currently simultaneously being run through the House and the Senate. They have a lot of similarities, but there are a few key differences. Thankfully, the differences are small enough that it seems like a bipartisan consensus will be able to be made with a little horse trading on the two perspectives. So for the House, the 8-week period will be extended to 24. For the Senate, they'd like the 8-week period to be extended to 16 weeks. For the House, they would like to eliminate the 75-25 split, payroll and non-payroll. They want to reduce that to 60% payroll, 40% non-payroll. The Senate wants to maintain the original 75-25 split. Elimination of restrictions on the loan term. Remember, right now, anything that isn't forgiven in the PPP forgiveness process remains a loan that you have to repay at a 1% interest rate in the final 18 months of the loan. And so that question is, do businesses are they going to be recovered enough to be able to really afford amortizing that whole PPP loan or remaining loan over 18 months? And a lot of legislators have realized we probably need to expand that 2 years to something more like 5, 7, or 10 years. And that exactly where that benchmark is still kind of moving through the public policy process. One of the other interesting and important changes is that the two acts that are currently running through the political process will allow companies to continue payroll tax deferment if you've taken a PPP loan. It seems kind of silly that you have to continue to pay payroll taxes while we recognize that your payroll is having to be supplemented through that PPP loan. So looks like there's going to be a little relief there. And then, of course, we're going to be looking at that rehiring deadline that deals with enhanced unemployment. So to say that in a kind of more business-friendly way, there are some proposals in the Senate, largely being led by Marco Rubio, that say, why don't we just take all the people who are currently getting enhanced unemployment and assume that they're going to get it through the end of the eligibility period? We'll just mash all of that together, give them a one-time lump sum payment, and then if they want to take the rest of the time off to look for a job or not work, that's fine. But if they want to get back to work right away, they can keep the unemployment money and go back and get a wage. Now, for some people, that feels a little surprising or even shocking, but for people who are trying to restart the economy and get employees engaged in the process of coming back to work, that feels like a way to kind of thread the needle of those economic incentives. So TBD, lots of opportunity for us to talk about that in Q&A if you're interested. Last kind of cool update, the House is going to vote today in the next day or so on H.R. 6782. It doesn't have a sexy name, but it has an interesting implication because it is going to require the SBA to issue a report disclosing all PPP loan recipients who receive loans over $2 million. So not only are those borrowers going to get enhanced scrutiny, but we'll now have a little bit more transparency, but also media coverage of how those funds were taken, how those funds were used. So again, stay tuned for more excitement in both the political and social arenas. I am officially done with this slide. I think I'm going to turn it back to you, Melody, to host our Q&A.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. I'm going to go ahead and take the slideshow down, and that will be available. We'll be happy to send that out. I do have a couple questions. One is, if you bring an employee back, because I know there's two components to the forgiveness. One is the FTE, so number of hours, you know, and one is the dollars. If you bring an employee back at a lower rate, how will that be considered for forgiveness? If the hours are the same, but their pay is a little different.
So that would fall into the wage reduction that reduces the amount of your loan forgiveness. If you bring an employee back and you're not paying them the full wages, or the, I shouldn't say full, the same salary or wages that they had before for the same hours, you do potentially get reduced the amount of forgiveness. However, it's only if and I'm reading here because I want to make sure I give you the right, the precise language. It's only if the reduction is in excess of 25% reduction. So there was a little bit of a recognition that in these times, employers might have to be reducing some pay. So I think an example is the easiest thing here. And here's an example that kind of is adapted directly from their example. So let's assume you reduced a full-time employee's weekly salary from $1,000 per week during your reference period to $700 per week in your covered period. So that's a reduction of $300, right? Mm-hmm. The employee continues to work. In this case, that first $250 of the $300 reduction, which is 25% of $1,000, it doesn't count. So you could reduce an employee's $1,000 pay by $250 and not affect your loan forgiveness at all. here, since you reduced it by 300, that extra 50 is going to affect the loan forgiveness. And so that extra 50 is going to actually reduce 50 per week. So over an 8-week period, it'll be $400 is going to reduce the pay. So gets a little tricky there in the math. It's not one of the easier math. It's more of a complicated math. But yeah, you do need to be wary, or you need to be cognizant of it. You may still have to do it, right? I mean, you have to make economic business decisions and weigh the factors. You may still have to reduce employee pay, but you just have to know the consequences of it.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. We have a couple other questions, and I know we only have a few minutes left. So I got a question about the company received a loan on May 8th. On May 15th, so the following week, they paid employees for the week previous to that. So so is that one of the things that would be counted in the alternate period that would be considered?
Yeah. So, well, you have a couple options there. If you got your loan on May 8th, you can start your covered period on May 8th. That would be the traditional covered period. Or you could wait to start your covered period on May 15th when your payroll started, when you paid your employees. And I should actually say, assuming in order to be able to use that alternative, you have to have biweekly or more frequent payroll periods. But yeah, I would say in that scenario, you can move the start date forward for your period to May 15th.
But would that not make the pay period essentially starting May 1st, since that's when they earned it, not when they paid it?
Well, you can, your covered expenses or your covered payroll costs are paid, are when they're paid. So the paid payroll within that period would count.
Okay.
Am I saying correctly, Rebecca? Yeah.
All right, perfect. And then I think we have time for one last question. Maybe we can squeeze another one in. 401k and group health insurance, is that included in the payroll costs?
I don't know if I know about 401k. If somebody else knows, jump in there. If it is a health insurance employer paid like premiums, that would count. That counts towards the ultimate compensation, but not if like there have been some other kind of questions of like payment of actual health benefits. And Tina might kind of have some thoughts on that. I saw you just come online. So. You're on mute, Tina.
Thank you. I will need to receive some clarification on that because it was not properly spelled out. We've had a lot of questions on the medical versus the ancillary versus the retirement. Yeah. We'll have to get some clarification. Yeah. We were waiting for their interpretation on that.
Okay, awesome. So I have two more questions. Let's see if we can squeeze them in. And I know we're going just a few minutes over. One is, does anyone have a recommendation for a software that could calculate payroll periods and gathering the information for submission? I don't know if that's
This is Rebecca. If you use a payroll provider, most of them are creating kind of standardized reports. If you don't use a payroll provider, there are a number of new applications, Excel spreadsheet software that are being marketed. One of the problems is this is such a new process, a new system. There hasn't been a lot of best practices or vetting of how good those software or systems are. So yes, they exist, but it's hard to endorse one because we haven't gone through the forgiveness yet. We don't know which ones are really giving the best results.
Awesome.
And you may ask some, and there's so many different lenders out there, and depending on your lender, it's going to be different. But I know for a fact there are some lenders, some of the smaller community banks in Central Florida, if you got one through them, that are trying to develop their own mechanisms for assisting borrowers, and they may or may not end up having them in that calculation. But you know, you may consider asking your lender again if it's a lender that you have a communication mechanism with. Some of the other lenders you might not be able to get as quick of information from, but ask your lender. And then, yeah, I agree with Rebecca. There's tons of resources out there, but it's hard to say which one's good right now because it hasn't been tested, hasn't been tried.
Awesome. All right, last question, and then I think we'll wrap up. There's a question: if people work from home and you usually are deducting your home office as your taxes, would there be a possibility for a portion of the utility or the mortgage that would be considered your office? Would that be able to be calculated in the forgivable amount?
So this is Rebecca, and we don't have specific guidance on that, but I can talk to you about the policy that the SBA is currently using for similar costs. So the question is going to become one between the SBA and the IRS. So if you're going to deduct that on your taxes next year, then you shouldn't be claiming it as a PPP cost. If you're not going to deduct it for this period of time, those 8 weeks or 9 weeks, then you may end up paying yourself for what that equivalent office use would be. So you really kind of get to pick your bucket, but because you're working at home, if you had traditionally deducted some piece of your home office through Schedule C or through some other deduction mechanism, you can continue to do so through the COVID-19 and PPP period. If that didn't answer your question accurately, please feel free to reach out to me offline and we can delve a little deeper into the mechanics of your exact situation.
All right, perfect. Thank you. All right, we're a little over time, so I appreciate everyone's sticking with us. We will have the deck available. We will have a recording available. If there's a question you didn't get answered and you'd like to email it in, we'd be happy to share it with the appropriate person to handle that. Otherwise, everyone have a lovely afternoon and be safe and wash your hands.